Shop the Sherwin-Williams 4-Day Super Sale and get 40% off paints and stains June 6th through the 9th. With prices starting at $29.39, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Shop the sale online or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.
Bah with the bah, da bang, da bang, newsy, newsy, dig it, said the newsy, said up, jump the newsy. Hello, Prestige Heads, and welcome to American Prestige. I'm Danny Bessner here, as always, with my friend and comrade, Derek Davison. And we
actually, I'm leaving.
And we are excited to bring you the news. Derek, let's jump into it. Let's start with Russia, Ukraine, and let's start with probably the biggest international news of the last week, which was this Ukrainian drone attack on Russia's strategic nuclear forces. So, Derek, what happened?
Yeah, this came as something of a surprise, I would say. On Sunday, the Ukrainian military carried out a series of drone strikes targeting air bases all over Russia, some of them in the east, actually, quite far from Ukraine. They attacked Russia's strategic bomber fleet. There were also, I think, some command and control planes that were targeted in this strike. It took the whole thing took... according to the reporting that I've seen since the attack, it took about 18 months to plan. They had to get these quadcopter drones smuggled into Russia and put on trucks in boxes and then release them at the right time when those trucks were near the bases that they were trying to target. So it's a fairly sophisticated operation, or at least a complex operation that they were able to pull off here. It's still unclear how much actual damage they were able to do. The Ukrainians claimed that they had struck 41 aircraft and completely destroyed 12 of them. It's impossible to really verify this. Some media outlets have started trying to do it based on satellite imagery of the bases that were targeted. So far, they've come up with, I think, 13 aircraft that were hit, definitely hit, or seem to have been hit according to the satellite imagery, which is a far cry from what the Ukrainians are claiming. But that's not that doesn't really mean that much, given how difficult it is to do these kinds of assessments. If they did destroy 12 bombers and let's say knock these other 29 out of commission that they're claiming, that's a significant dent in Russia's strategic bomber fleet. They have, I think, 120 or so aircraft of old Soviet era designs that are no longer being manufactured that would have been, you know, the primary targets here. So that's percentage wise, you're talking about 10% maybe taken out, maybe another 20% or so that are going to need to be repaired of aircraft that, as I say, are no longer in production. And then, you know, they have a few more recent, more modern bombers. I don't know that any of those were targeted, but there's a small number. So this could affect the Russian war effort to some degree. It's nothing they can't eventually recover from, certainly, but for the time being, their tactics of standing off and firing on Ukrainian cities from well outside the range of Ukrainian air defenses could be affected somewhat. I think the bigger impact is probably in terms of kind of supply chains and logistics. The Russians now have to be concerned about this kind of attack happening again, even though, as I say, it took the Ukrainians quite a while to plan and implement this one. Still, they have to be on the lookout for this kind of thing, which could, influence how they treat cargo shipments, how they treat cargo trucks moving around the country. Anything like that could come up the works. I should add, the Ukrainians also, in the last few days, have carried out a couple of sabotage attacks on Russian bridges. There were bridges in Bryansk and Kursk oblasts that were damaged or destroyed in phantom explosions, or explosions that the Russians haven't attributed to anybody, but let's be realistic about this. Kind of overnight into Sunday, I believe, the Crimean Bridge, which is the bridge that crosses the Kerch Strait and connects the Crimean Peninsula to Russia, the Ukrainians also bombed that early Tuesday morning. The Ukrainian Security Service took credit for that attack. It was temporarily closed. It doesn't sound like the damage was that severe. But they've carried out a number of sabotage type attacks, I guess, in the last few days, maybe demonstrating to the Russians that they're still capable of waging a war if the Russians are not going to negotiate a peace deal or ceasefire, at least. Also maybe demonstrating to Donald Trump that Ukraine is still in the fight here. And supposedly, according to Axios, he was impressed by the drone attack. So for whatever that's worth, I guess.
It's worth a lot, Derek. It's worth a lot.
I suppose.
Let's talk about these peace talks, which happened last Monday.
Right. The peace talks happened in the wake of the drone attack, the Operation Spiderweb. I forgot to mention its cool code name, the Operation Spiderweb attack. So, that cast a little bit of a shadow on these peace talks. Not that anybody was expecting much to come of it anyway. This was the second round of peace talks that the Ukrainians and Russians held in Istanbul. It came after the previous one last month. Both sides agreed to submit to one another these memoranda outlining their various requirements in any peace deal. The Ukrainians sent theirs to Russia. Russia decided to wait and hold on to it until the next session of talks, and then kind of unleash it on the Ukrainians. At that time, they didn't get anything done. I mean, meeting expectations, I think they didn't really get anything substantive done. There was another agreement to do a prisoner swap, which was the big outcome from the first session in Istanbul. So they did agree to do another one of those, but they didn't make any headway on a ceasefire. The Ukrainians proposed, again, their 30-day ceasefire that the Russians rejected. The Russians proposed a 2 or 3 day limited pause in certain areas of the front line that the Ukrainians rejected. The peace memorandum that the Russians put forward was basically just a restatement of all the demands they've had so far. They want full recognition of Russian control over, all the territory that they've set foot in Ukraine. They want guarantees that Ukraine will never be in NATO, et cetera. It's these very maximalist demands, which the Ukrainians have refused to countenance. There was a proposal made for a third session of talks. I don't know what they would talk about at this point. Maybe another prisoner swap or exchange of remains or something like that. But substantively, they seem so far apart that I really don't. I don't see a lot of room for further discussion at this point.
This one is pretty interesting because I think it suggests something about the U.S. policy toward Ukraine. But it seems that on Wednesday, Putin and Trump had a phone call. So what do we know what they talked about?
What we know is that Putin vented about the attacks over the previous few days, particularly the drone attack, which the Russians I know you'll appreciate this, in maybe the worst, and this is saying something for somebody who follows American foreign policy, the worst bastardization of the term terrorism that I've ever heard, called the drone attack on Russian military air bases that destroyed Russian military aircraft an act of terrorism. Just beyond any dictionary definition.
It's wild how that now just means anyone just means attacked.
We got attacked. Ever. Yeah, somebody attacked us, and we don't recognize their right to do it. So it's terrorism in the middle of a war, right? He vented, apparently, according to Trump, said that Russia will retaliate for this attack. It has to retaliate for this attack. This was Trump's phrasing. You could argue that they've already more than retaliated for it over the course of the last couple of years, but who am I to say? That was really it. I didn't hear any other discussion of anything having to do with the Russia-Ukraine war. And I think, to your point, the U.S., the Trump administration, at least, is starting to de-emphasize the war in its relationship with Russia. Like, it wants to do
precisely
other things with Russia.
I think that's what's happening.
And just ignore basically what's happening in Ukraine, which leads, we can talk about this, it leads to some interesting possibilities. But they did talk about the U.S.-Iranian nuclear negotiations, which is the kind of thing that you do with your, great power buddies, I guess. Which we'll talk about the talks later, but Putin offered to help clear the log jam that they're currently in. So, that was nice. He's a good guy, nice guy. It was more like a call between two major world leaders than anything specifically related to the war.
Derek, I think that Putin's going to try to get him, help him get a deal on Iran. And I think Trump is going to stop aiding Ukraine. That's what I think is going to happen. What do you think about that?
So I don't know if Trump's going to stop aiding Ukraine. He's going to stop sending weapons, I think, or they've already stopped really sending weapons. Like they're still sending the weapons that were authorized under the Biden administration. Like they're running out that pot of money that was allocated during the last year of the Biden administration. But there's not even any discussion about creating a new pot of money or adding to that pot of money to continue things. So they're like running that string out. But beyond that, I don't think there's going to be any more weapons coming from the U.S. The big question, and this was in the New York Times this week, actually, the big question is whether or not they're going to stop sharing intelligence with the Ukrainians. You may recall that for a couple of days after he got mad at Volodymyr Zelensky in the Oval Office, Trump did cut off intelligence sharing to the Ukrainians. And it was really, really, really painful for the Ukrainian military. They rely on U.S. intelligence for a lot. And that's something, unlike weapons, where European governments feel like they're building up their capacity and can step in to kind of fill the gap if the U.S. stops sending weapons. The intel, the Europeans don't have that capability. They could develop it, but it'll take time. The U.S. does. And so, the question would be, is he going to go all the way and just cut Ukraine off, even from this, non-material stuff? And I don't know yet. I mean, he hasn't so far, which is interesting. He's been frustrated. Wednesday's call notwithstanding, he's been frustrated with Putin lately. I mean, he's done these, kind of unhinged social media posts about how Putin's gone crazy and something's happened to him and I don't know what to do. And it's, it's really frustrating. So, that may carry him for a while. It may be that he's got people within the administration who can convince him or have convinced him that, it's okay to keep sending Ukraine intel. If Putin, delivers on something, if he delivers on Iran or if he delivers on something else that Trump is interested in and then says, by the way, you're still helping Ukraine here. Could you knock it off? Who knows? I mean, really, who knows at this point with Trump about anything? But I do think you're potentially looking at a shift here. But the question is how big a one.
Remains to be seen, and we at American Prestige will keep you updated. All right, Derek, let's move on to Israel-Palestine, and let's begin with these attacks on the aid centers.
Multiple mass shootings at this point over the week plus that the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation has been in operation, and they've had aid distribution centers, I think three operating in southern Gaza and one kind of in central Gaza. There have been multiple incidents of the IDF. Allegedly, I guess, in a couple of them, the Israelis insist that nothing happened or that their soldiers just fired warning shots and then people, I guess, happened to drop dead. But, you know, it's still in dispute to some degree. But these incidents of crowds of people just being gunned down as they were moving toward these aid distribution facilities. In one case, on Sunday, at least 31 people were killed. Scores of people were wounded. Witnesses described not just, you know, kind of gunfire, fire from drones. They described shelling from tanks, which, you know, is pretty clearly an IDF operation in that point. The Israelis, as I say, have repeatedly said that they're just firing warning shots at people who are approaching their troops in a threatening way, which could be anything. It could just be starving people turning the wrong way down a street and then getting, you know, opened up on. There was another incident, at least 27 people were killed, I believe, on Tuesday. You know, and then you hear reports of kind of small numbers of people, six here, you know, half a dozen here, five here, kind of being killed in similar circumstances, always around these GHF aid distribution centers. There was concern when the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation plan emerged with these centralized nodes of aid distribution rather than a more dispersed system, the way that the United Nations and other humanitarian groups were operating, that aid could be weaponized. But I think what people meant was that, you know, the Israelis could deny aid to unacceptable Palestinians, not that the IDF would just start, you know, kind of taking targets of opportunity and the people who are masked up and queued up to get aid and start shooting at them. But that seems to be what's happening. Now, the GHF suspended operations on Wednesday. It claimed that it needed to do renovation on its distribution sites. You know, they've been open for a whole week. And so, you know, they needed some fixing, I guess. It's unclear how much of a direct connection there is between all of these shooting incidents and the decision to shut down. They, I think, reopened a couple of sites on Thursday, but not fully. So it's hard not to draw some connections there. I will say the GHF also lost its main logistics provider, Boston Consulting Group, which claims it's been working pro bono for the GHF, although the Washington Post reported they've been billing for, you know, $1 million or more per month. But it decided to terminate its contract with the foundation, possibly, again, because of all the shooting incidents. And there was some suggestion in the Washington Post report about this, that the foundation would have a difficult time continuing to function without the support of that firm, Boston Consulting Group. So, you know, they may be this whole like renovation cover story is probably standing in for something more serious.
All right, Derek, let's talk about this American veto of the UN ceasefire resolution that was proposed.
Shocking, I know. But yeah, the Trump administration vetoed another UN Security Council ceasefire resolution on Wednesday. The vote was 14-1 in favor of the ceasefire. It just so happens that that one belonged to the U.S. and the U.S. has a veto. So guess what? It didn't happen. You know, I don't want to say it would have been that lopsided had the U.S. not made its plans to veto clear beforehand. Maybe some other members would have been reluctant to vote in favor. Who knows? But yeah, it's I think indicative of something that has been apparent for quite some time now, is that all of this talk of, much like with the Biden administration, all this talk of pressure or frustration, or, you know, the Trump administration is behind the scenes kind of leaning on the Israelis to do this or that, it's all bullshit. Israel still has full impunity and diplomatic cover and protection from the United States to do whatever it wants. And indeed, from even the European countries that have been more kind of vocal about their criticism of what's going on in Gaza, but are still buying Israeli weapons and still allowing shipments of weapons from the U.S. to come through their ports. There was a report on the Netherlands just earlier today that I saw that, you know, it's all, everything's still going on as normal. Israel is getting the protection it wants from its patrons. It's getting the support it wants from its patrons. They're just complaining, they're grousing in public a little bit ineffectually about it. When the rubber hits the road, it's still, you know, unchanged, really.
And let's move on to these ceasefire talks.
Right. Haaretz had a report on Wednesday that said that mediators are pressuring Hamas to basically accept a ceasefire on Israeli terms. The big sticking point in the negotiations has been that Hamas wants a firm commitment that whatever temporary truce is agreed to will lead to a full cessation of hostilities, indefinite cessation of hostilities. What's going on right now is that I guess the Qataris, the Egyptians, and the new figure in these negotiations, which is the Palestinian businessman Bishara Bahba, who's a Trump guy, worked with Trump in Michigan during the campaign, is acting also as an unofficial envoy now for the Trump administration, meeting with Hamas officials and trying to pressure them into just going along with what the Israelis want, which is a 60-day truce with no assurances of anything beyond that, with a partial release of captives. He's trying to convince them, trying to convince Hamas that if they agree to the 60-day truce, then Donald Trump is going to swoop in magically and insist on an extension at least through the end of 2025, if not something more indefinite. There's nothing, there's no reason that Hamas should believe any of this. They've been sold a bill of goods by the Trump administration multiple times now over the past few months that they were going to pressure Israel into a long-term ceasefire, long-term cessation of hostilities, and a military withdrawal from Gaza, only to find that they, as soon as they, get Hamas to agree to something, they turn around and, don't do anything to pressure the Israelis, and things continue on as normal. There's not a lot of credibility here when Bahba tells them that Trump's going to do this, which may be why they haven't already accepted things. Now, there is the Eid al-Adha holiday that begins, I believe, Thursday at sundown in most places. Some places will wait until Friday, but it's there was some pressure to try and get a deal announced either before that holiday begins or during the holiday. It seems unlikely to me, but Hamas certainly may be feeling some pressure to even to agree to something that doesn't meet their standards or crosses their red lines, just to get a pause in what's going on.
Thanks, Derek. Let's talk about Iran, and let's begin with this new International Atomic Energy Agency report that just came out.
Right. The IAEA has been investigating Iranian nuclear activity for, decades, I guess, at this point. But it's particularly over the last few years been investigating a couple of issues related to the discovery during the period when the Iran nuclear deal was in full effect and inspectors were able to get into Iranian sites. IAEA inspectors were able to get into Iranian sites fairly easily. There was a discovery of a couple of trace amounts of nuclear material at sites that the Iranian government had not previously declared at nuclear sites. And so that led to a whole investigation into what were they doing? Why was there nuclear material at these sites? What were they doing there? The Iranians have not, according to the agency at least, have not been terribly cooperative. And so this has been a back and forth for a few years now. The IAEA released a report this week, basically saying, while we don't have all the facts here, partly because we've been, stonewalled in our investigation, we do believe that Iran engaged in experimental nuclear weapons related work at these sites using this nuclear material prior to the decision in the early 2000s to suspend that work. This matters to, sort of the international harangue about Iran's nuclear program because European countries and the U.S. would like clarity about just how far along this research went and how quickly could Iran do the things necessary to develop a nuclear weapon if it were to decide to do that and if it were to enrich its uranium to the level that would be required for a weapon. How quickly could they do, put together the triggers, the warhead, all the other technical things that would go into developing a weapon. So it matters in that sense. It could have an impact on U.S.-Iranian nuclear talks, which are stalled over the enrichment issue. We'll get to that in a moment. But it's I think worth noting the existence of this report. It will probably be used later this month at the IAEA's quarterly meeting by the U.S. and France, Germany, and the United Kingdom to push for a resolution that censures Iran or otherwise kind of scolds it for not cooperating with the negotiation and for whatever work it was doing in secret. The Iranians will probably react badly to that. We don't know how serious the resolution will be or what the potential kind of outcome of it would be. In theory, the U.S. and the European countries could take their case to the U.N. Security Council to try and reimpose sanctions against Iran. The Iranians could react in a way that, you know, makes things more difficult in terms of the nuclear talks if they were to suddenly decide to rapidly increase their enrichment behavior or some other thing, is, you know, to sort of thumb their nose at the IAEA and to the U.S. and companies. So who knows? There's a lot of uncertainty about this and how it will play out.
What about a Khamenei's response to this American proposal?
Yeah, over the weekend, it was reported that Steve Witkoff, the Trump administration envoy, had put together a new outline for a proposal and sent it to the Iranians. It's really unclear at this point what specifically was in that proposal, mostly around the issue of uranium enrichment. And this is because the Trump administration's position on whether Iran should be allowed to maintain a uranium enrichment program changes almost by the day, if not more rapidly. You get, various times you've had plans proposed or officials say things like, we would allow the Iranians to maintain an enrichment program under limits, under inspections, which are things that the Iranians have accepted. They've already accepted them. They accepted them in the 2015 nuclear deal, and they've suggested that they would be open to accepting those things again. There's this scheme that's been kicked around about, which was also talked about in 2015, about creating a consortium of countries in the Persian Gulf who are either currently operating nuclear reactors or are interested in operating nuclear reactors. So that can include the Saudis, the UAE, Bahrain, who would all kind of contribute to this consortium that would produce the uranium fuel for those nuclear power plants and would be under, again, international supervision, international operation to kind of make sure that there's no weaponization there. And the Iranians have, again, said they'd be open to something like that, but not if it comes at the expense of their own domestic enrichment program, which they regard as a national right. And also a matter of national security to maintain fuel for their reactors. From what was reported, proposed a continued Iranian enrichment activity for a certain temporary period of time under strict limits, after which, in theory, this consortium would take over and the Iranians would no longer need to enrich uranium or be allowed to enrich uranium. It's unclear. Anyway, Khamenei trashed this in a televised speech on Wednesday for the reasons I've already outlined. He said it is 100% against, that was his term, the principles of independence and self-reliance, which are both kind of principles of the Iranian revolution and of the current government, kind of pillars of its nationals, kind of self-regard. He didn't outright reject the idea of doing a nuclear deal, so there's room for negotiations to continue, but he did kind of lay out a marker here that he's not going to accept any deal that would require Iran to seek permission from the U.S. To maintain a uranium enrichment program. And the Trump administration, if it's going to insist that Iran can't have a program, this is a gap that probably cannot be bridged, but we'll see.
We shall see. All right, let's talk about Trump and China. Trump is mad at China, Derek. Why?
Yeah, so you may recall that last month, the U.S. and China had a little trade meeting in Switzerland, in Geneva, to try to start to iron out their various disagreements. Lowering tariffs and otherwise kind of relaxing restrictions on trade, leading up, ideally, the idea was that it would lead up to a meeting between Trump and Xi Jinping. The What happened was on Friday, Trump took to social media, where he still does his best work, to complain that the Chinese government has totally violated its agreement with us. And he said he would no longer be Mr. Nice Guy in his dealings with China. It was surprising to hear that he'd been Mr. Nice Guy in the past. But what he seems to be on about is that the Chinese government imposed export controls or export restrictions on critical minerals to the U.S. And China has a real bottleneck on much of the global trade in critical minerals. These are things for, you know, batteries, for, you know, electronics, various metals, materials that are important for those things. And they've over the, you know, as Trump's trade war on China has unfolded, they've been imposing these, you know, stronger and stronger restrictions on the export of those materials to the U.S. One of the things they apparently agreed to do in Geneva was to relax those restrictions, and they haven't done that. Now, the Chinese government says it made no such commitment at Geneva and that it hasn't violated any agreement. It's taken offense at what Trump has said. But still, it feels like we're sort of back to square one in terms of the trade war. Now, that said, Trump did talk with Xi Jinping by phone on Thursday. I haven't seen much in the way of detail because it just happened not long before we recorded this. But that could break something here. It could cause some you know, kind of free up the jam in this relationship to some degree. Depending on how the call went, we'll have to wait and see.
This Father's Day at Lowe's, score free gifts for the greatest dad. Right now, get a free select DeWalt, Craftsman, or Kobalt tool with purchase of a select battery kit. Plus, get a free Werner 2-foot aluminum ladder when you buy an 8-foot fiberglass ladder. Shop these deals and more this Father's Day at Lowe's. We help, you save. Valid through 6/15 while supplies last. Selection varies by location.
Let's talk about the South Korean presidential election.
This is the election, as people probably know, it was made necessary by the impeachment of former President Yoon Suk-yeol for his attempted ill-conceived self-coup back in December. Yoon has since been impeached and removed from office, necessitating a snap election. As expected, as polling indicated all along the way, the Democratic Party's Lee Jae-myung, who lost to Yoon in 2022, won fairly handily. He took, I think, a little over 49% of the vote. The People Power Party, which is was Yoon's party, their nominee Kim Moon-soo conceded the race. He finished about 8 points, I think, behind Lee. Yeah, it's Lee has already taken office. There's no transition period in one of these snap elections. You know, it happens almost immediately. So Lee has already taken office as president. He's promised to improve relations with North Korea, improve relations with China, strengthen relations with the U.S. and Japan, basically a no problems with anybody scheme. I don't think he's going to be able to pull that off, but I guess it's good to come in with some dreams and then see what happens. But yeah, that's where things stand. This took place, the snap election took place on Tuesday. Lee became president Wednesday night after the official tally was announced. So, you know, it's still early. He's got time to, you know, fall on his face, I guess.
Speaking of elections, let's talk about the Polish presidential election.
The Polish runoff took place on Sunday. It pitted the top two finishers in the first round last month against each other. Warsaw Mayor Rafał Trzaskowski and the far right academic Karol Nawrocki. Nawrocki won. It's a little, well, I don't know if it was a surprise. It was bound to be a close fought race, it seemed like, in polling, and Nawrocki took under 51% of the vote, so it was a pretty narrow margin victory. Nevertheless, it could have significant implications. Nawrocki is a Eurosceptic, so his election will have effects on Poland's relationship with the European Union, no doubt. It's also going to have an effect on the current Polish government. Donald Tusk, the prime minister, and his centrist coalition were really hoping for Cheskowski to win. And Navrocki's victory leaves them with the same situation they have now with Andrzej Duda as president, another far right president who doesn't really agree with their agenda, that they'll have to do a tug of war with. The government is more powerful in the Polish system. The prime minister, more powerful position than the president. But the president still has a number of ways, number of levers to sort of gum up the works. So this is something that Tusk will have to deal with. He has called for a parliamentary confidence vote. It's going to take place next week. Just to sort of see if his coalition is still together. One assumes that it is and that he will win the confidence vote, which will give him some stability as he kind of heads into what is sure to be an adversarial relationship with the new head of state.
Let's stay in Europe and let's talk about the collapse of the Dutch government.
Friend of the pod, Geert Wilders, far right guy with the crazy hair, leader of the Party for Freedom, has been threatening for a couple of weeks to withdraw the Party for Freedom, the PVV, from the Netherlands governing coalition. The PVV won the 2023 parliamentary election in the Netherlands. Didn't finish. I mean, you know, Dutch politics, you typically have to form a coalition rather than any party winning outright. And so he managed to form a coalition despite the sort of distaste that I think a lot of centrist parties had about working with Wilders and the PVV, managed to form a coalition, but he's been threatening for the last, as I say, couple of weeks to pull out of the coalition because none of the other parties in it were interested in his proposal to just stop accepting asylum cases, which is a violation of international law in addition to, you know, sort of just distasteful overall. And so, you know, he's very angry about that. He decided this week to make good on his threat. On Tuesday, he pulled the PVV out of the government, causing the coalition to collapse. Prime Minister Dick Schoof resigned. He will stay on in a caretaker capacity, most likely through an election that I don't believe has been scheduled yet. It'll probably take place sometime later this summer, maybe in the early fall. The question is, you know, whether Wilders has made a miscalculation here, and it's possible. Polling has indicated, to the extent that we can rely on polling, I guess, has indicated that the PVV's public opinion or public support has dropped quite a bit since 2023, and that it's now one of three parties that's sort of vying for, you know, who would emerge from the election as the largest bloc in parliament. And without a decisive win such as the one PVV enjoyed in 2023, it's entirely possible that a coalition of other parties will form to kind of restore what had been a cordon sanitaire around PVV and Wilders and exclude him and exclude the party from government. We'll have to, you know, see how the election plays out, obviously. But this may wind up being a bit of a miscalculation on his part. I don't know.
We shall see. Let's move south to North Africa and tell us about these bodies that the United Nations discovered at militia sites in Libya in Tripoli.
Right. Volker Turk, the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, announced on Wednesday that the discovery of what he said were dozens of bodies that had been found at sites that were previously used as detention facilities by one of the many militias that kind of roams around the city of Tripoli, the ostensible capital of Libya. In this case, it was the Stability Support Apparatus Militia, which people may recall a few weeks ago. There was a battle in Tripoli between that militia and forces that are more closely aligned with the Government of National Unity, the ostensible internationally recognized government of Libya that operates out of Tripoli. Those forces were able to kill the leader of the SSA, Abdel Ghani al-Kikli, and expelled his militia from its stronghold in the Abu Salim neighborhood of Tripoli. Now, I guess they've moved into these sites that were used as detention facilities and found just, you know, untold numbers of bodies in freezers and, you know, kind of buried, or not even buried, but indications, according to Turk, that they were tortured, extrajudicially executed, et cetera, et cetera. So really some disturbing stuff. I don't know whether there's going to be any attempt to sort of prosecute anybody, the law enforcement, as you might expect. Law enforcement capacity in a failed state like Libya is not great. But certainly some disturbing news from the UN.
Thanks, Derek. Let's move west now to Morocco and tell us about the United Kingdom recognizing sovereignty over Western Sahara.
Yeah, UK Foreign Minister David Lammy announced over the weekend, I believe, that the UK now supports Moroccan sovereignty over Western Sahara, which is disputed between the Moroccan government, which makes a claim on it, and the Polisario Front, the Sahrawi independence movement. The Moroccan government a few years ago proposed what they called an autonomy plan for Western Sahara, that, in other words, it would belong to Morocco, but it would be free to kind of, govern itself in most respects. This is, dubious given that the Moroccan government is a pretty absolutist monarchy. Nevertheless, it has won over a number of supporters in Europe. France, Germany, Spain, the UK now becomes, the next major European state to fall in line behind this plan. The US, you may recall, started this ball rolling in 2020 when the Trump administration, first term, agreed to recognize Moroccan sovereignty over Western Sahara as the quid pro quo for Morocco joining the Abraham Accords and normalizing relations with Israel. So it's, it's just kind of mushroomed from there. And each one of these announcements, every time this happens, when France did it, Germany did it, Spain did it, has drawn an angry response from the Algerian government, which supports the Polisario Front. And it really is more just opposed to Morocco than anything else. And the Algerian foreign ministry did criticize Lammy's statement. I'm not sure if the Algerian government's going to do anything more with that. Its relationship with France really took a nosedive after the French kind of came on board with the Moroccan autonomy plan. There was some diplomatic, back and forth, some commercial repercussions in terms of gas sales and so forth. I don't think the UK is as kind of open to reprisal from Algeria as France was. Probably we won't see much more than the condemnation they've already made. But still, it's continuing to kind of move in the direction of Western Sahara just being recognized, I guess, by the major powers as part of Morocco.
Thanks, Derek. And as always, we conclude with the United States, where Trump has brought back the travel ban.
He's playing his hits, like he's playing the hits from the first term. He announced on Wednesday that he is bringing back the travel ban. As of Monday, the U.S. will no longer be accepting anyone arriving from 12 countries, Afghanistan, Chad, Equatorial Guinea, Eritrea, Haiti, Iran, Libya, Myanmar, the Republic of the Congo, Somalia, Sudan, and Yemen. It is also, the administration is imposing what it called heightened restrictions on anyone arriving from 7 other countries, Burundi, Cuba, Laos, Sierra Leone, Togo, Turkmenistan, and Venezuela. And somehow this is going to make America safe from something. I don't know. But it's going to protect our national security. That's Trump's argument here. Early in his term, I think on his first day, on one of that kind of slew of executive orders he signed, authorized, I believe it was the Department of Homeland Security and maybe the intelligence community, to produce a report on countries that have hostile attitudes toward the U.S. And I guess this is the outgrowth of that, is that, if you don't like us, we don't want you coming here. Okay, sure enough. Fair enough. That's where this is. It'll probably be challenged in court, although people may recall the travel ban in the first term was also challenged in court when it was really just obviously a ban on people coming to the U.S. from predominantly Muslim countries. It was struck down for that reason, and so then they rejiggered it to change the list a bit to kind of downplay the Muslim aspect and add some countries that are not predominantly Muslim, and then it was upheld. So I suspect this one has already been written, it seems like, to be broader based than just a Muslim ban, and will probably pass muster with the courts, but we'll see.
Well, thank you, Derek. And thank you, everyone, for listening. And if you've made it this far, please do consider liking the pod and reviewing it and rating it on Apple iTunes. You guys have really been helpful with that. We really do appreciate it. We've got, I think, a couple of hundred more reviews since I asked for it. And we still need about 180-ish more, I think, to crack that 1,000 barrier, which is actually pretty crucial for getting people to know about the show. So thank you again for listening. And if you aren't a subscriber yet, please know that you could subscribe for $60 and get not only all of your favorite American prestige content, all the bonus content that you love, but a digital subscription to The Nation as well. So thank you all for listening, and we will see you soon. And as always, keep rocking in the free world. Bye.
Bye.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams 4-Day Super Sale and get 40% off paints and stains June 6th through the 9th. With prices starting at $29.39, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Shop the sale online or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity, and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.